Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Well, today we have gardening expert, UPR friend Dan Drost on the program. He's going to answer your gardening questions. And, of course, whether you've got a large backyard garden or participate in a community garden, maybe you have a small box near your window, Dan can help with your gardening questions. So here's how you get those questions to him. A couple ways. Email upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or call 435-797-8877, 435-797-8877. Note that that number has changed. The university switched over to Zoom, it's quite convenient for the phone. The process that zapped our 800 number that we all have tattooed on our brains. So use this one, 435-797-8877. So Dan Drost is Emeritus Professor of Horticulture and Extension Vegetable Specialist in Department of Plant, Soils, and Climate, Utah State University. Longtime contributor to Utah Public Radio, gives us gardening advice on the green thumb, for example. And Dan, thanks for coming in.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's a lovely day out there again, a little bit frosty, but that's okay. Sun's going to shine and it's going to be warm. I talked to my relatives back in Wisconsin. They had 3 feet of snow.
Three feet of snow.
And then drifts higher than that because it was blowing so bad. You know, the winds that they projected for here weren't nearly as strong as they kind of early anticipated, but my Wisconsin relatives said they were hammered and they got snowed in and, you know, stranded for a few days in places that they didn't want to be. But for the most part, they're starting to dig themselves out and get back to normal. And
yeah,
and so, yeah, you know, let's be happy we have what we have, even though it's kind of depressing to see the lack of snow up in the mountain, which is going to have an impact, I think, in some ways on how we garden and how we farm this year here in the state. And so, you know, we can always talk a little bit about water because that's something that I talked about, I think, over all the years. And
yeah, for sure. Well, yeah, let's start there. But kind of wondering, I think you all are wondering about that. A very dry winter again.
Yeah, and I think the issue for agriculture is not dire, but because, you know, so much of the water rights to various rivers and streams primarily goes to agriculture. And that, I think, sometimes perplexes people. But, you know, I have to understand water law, and it's not our place right now here to talk about water law, but it's always good to kind of keep in mind that water was originally developed to help agriculture get developed here in the state. And then as the population grows, of course, we all consume water. I took a shower this morning and I had, you know, a glass of water with my breakfast, and I, you know, make a coffee for myself, and I use the toilet and all of those things that take water. And when the summer comes, then, you know, we use our culinary water in our gardens and in our landscapes. And so the university has been very proactive about trying to get people to understand how to conserve, how to manage, how to minimize waste, you know, check your sprinkler systems and do all those types of things. And so there are programs available throughout the urban areas of Utah that help you do that. And so I would really advocate many of our listeners to think about trying to go and get that service done this year, or do it yourself, because there are ways you can do it yourself to, you know, make sure that the water's going where it's supposed to go. So check your sprinkler systems when they're up and running. Be careful about how often they're running. I have a neighbor who runs his every day, and it's a rental property, and they just turn it on April 1st. We don't need water on April 1st, and they turn it off on November 1st. And, you know, sometimes their lawn looks nice and green, but if you look at it closely, it's mostly moss, lots of weeds, because it's not really being managed properly, and that's just wasteful. And so, you know, let's kind of, you know, use that as an impetus this year to help us get through and manage the lack of water that we have.
Are there certain plants, certain vegetables or whatever you could plant that are
more water-wise?
More water-wise, yes.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Think about the plant. I always use the analogy of how tall the plant grows is how deep the root goes. Okay, so you kind of see that's a little ditty that you can help think about things. So things like spinach and lettuce and radishes and onion, you know, they don't grow very tall in your garden, and therefore their roots occupy a fairly shallow layer in the soil profile. And so big plants like a watermelon plant or a corn plant even a tomato plant, they have very deep roots. And so watering those plants every day is problematic for them, because then you just keep their roots up in the shallow part, and then they start consuming lots of water. And so you say, oh, they're wilting, I need to water them again. That's the wrong approach. So if we can start by thinking about what plants we want to put in our garden this year, and we zone them by height, so small plants together, intermediate size plants together, tall plants together, then we can kind of zone where we're irrigating as well, and that way we're going to use less water. So things like spinach and lettuce, which have shallow roots, we may need to water three times a week, whereas tomatoes, I never water mine more than one time a week. And I give them a good soak, and it gets the water deep into the profile, and the plant uses it, and the productivity is just fine. So there's really good conservation ways, even in our own gardens, to do that. Now, are there water-efficient plants? Well, yes and no. Most of them aren't bred for water efficiency. They're bred for maximum productivity. That's what we really kind of desire. We want lots of potatoes, and we want lots of tomatoes, and we want, you know, big broccoli heads and those kinds of things. And so the breeders have worked hard to kind of get those traits in it, and haven't really focused too much on water efficiency components within the vegetable field. And so that's something that we probably have to kind of think about.
I'm looking at your Green Thumb segment for March.
Yep.
You have one about every month here, and so it's kicking off spring gardening. One thing that I've focused on here, I think that people really need to focus on, is the soil. So you're talking about soil temperature here.
Yeah, I think there's different components to it. First of all, we need to be thinking about when we plant based on the temperature of the soil. And so those plants that like it cooler, like spinach and lettuce and radish, carrot, those things, you know, those we can actually start planting. And so I'm going to start planting certain things in my garden tomorrow. I have transplants that I'm growing in the house that I'm going to plant out probably late next week, you know, almost around the first of April. That's when I'm going to start putting some of those early transplants out of those same kind of crops. Now, I'm transplanting so I get some early productivity out of them, and I'm seeding simply because I want to have some stuff that gets sustained a little bit later into the season. So I'm kind of doing those two things, and I'm tracking soil temperature. Well, what I did this year is I built myself a cold frame. I had some clear fiberglass material lying around. I decided to build myself a small cold frame this winter. It gives me something to do. I always wanted one. I've never really had the time. I've always used kind of floating row covers or something like that to, you know, kind of protect the area and try to warm up the air around the plants. Well, this is going to give me some heat in the soil. And I was checking those temperatures yesterday, and it was a cold, kind of coolish cold day. I mean, the soil temperatures were in the high 50s, which is actually perfect for those cool season vegetables. And so we're going to get a little bit warmer stuff. You know, certainly if you want to get started early, a cold frame can do that for you. And if you don't know what a cold frame is or don't know how to build a cold frame, the USU Extension website, you can go in and look at that. And there are examples of how to build, how to use, how to manage all those types of structures in your home garden, in addition to just laying a frost blanket or something like that over top of plants when it's kind of cold out. So there's no real reason why we can't start planting pretty early. And kind of the old wives' tale or the farmer's almanac says, well, you know, if you really want good peas, you should start planting those on St. Patrick's Day. And so I'm wearing green in here. Nobody can see that, but I'm wearing green today in honor of my, you know, Irish ancestors, which I have no Irish ancestors. So, but anyway, it's St. Paddy's Day. And so as a result of that, you know, you can get started on this provided, you know, conditions are right. Not every year do we get that, but this year is an exception. So, you know, I'm starting a little bit earlier than I normally do. And many years, I usually start right around the last week of March or the early week, the early weeks of April to try and get things going. Mm.
Been a little warmer this year. Of course, we had a little cold spell lately, yeah. But maybe that accelerates things. Yeah.
Right? Well, and it does. And so, you know, there's kind of the trade-offs. I mean, I'm not a good predictor of what the future is going to bring, and we can still have some coolish, coldish type weathers. We might even get some snow and those types of things. But my hot frame or my hot house that I built in the garden, it stands about 12 to 14 inches tall. It's clear fiberglass material around the outsides of it, and it's got a lid on the top of it that's clear as well, and it picks up a lot of heat during the day, and even on cold days, it's significantly warmer in there than it is outside, and that's what's going to give me that earliness. So mm-hmm. I'll be sowing seeds in there. I'll leave some space available for the lettuce transplants and the spinach transplants and the kale that I have, and then toward the end of next week, I'll be putting out my broccoli plants are ready. My Brussels sprouts or plants are ready. I'll be putting those out. And those won't mature now until sometime in, you know, late May or maybe early June. But if I don't get them out now, certainly they'll mature before the heat of summer comes on. And that's really exactly what I want them to do. So trying to get yourself geared up. And many of our nurseries and garden centers and things like that, if we go into them, they're starting to get plants in as well in anticipation of all these types of things, because they understand that they have to have plants available for those early planters, and this is a perfect year to start early planting. Mm-hmm. So first off, that soil, like you said, we got to get that temperature right in order to do that.
What's the right temperature?
Well, for cool season vegetables like spinach and lettuce and carrot and that type of stuff, if our soil temperatures get up around 55 or 60 degrees, in the planting zone, which is pretty shallow, so right up near the surface, that's a good time to start planting for them. Now, for things like pepper and squashes and tomato, I'm not going to do any of those unless I have myself a hothouse or a cold frame or some bigger type of structure that I'm going to plant those into. And then maybe I can get away with it by doing some other manipulations. I thought a little later in the hour we can talk about some of that kind of stuff too, because if I had myself a hot high tunnel, I would be planting stuff in that high tunnel actually way into February, and I would be planting tomatoes and peppers here about the middle of April, you know, to try and get my early tomatoes and that type of stuff. So if you have one of those little tiny greenhouses that you start seeing people buying and things like that, there's a lot more things that you can do, and you can do them a lot earlier. I always say about 6 weeks maybe earlier than what you would do normally outdoors. Mm-hmm. That's a good rule of thumb.
Right. What about soil quality? You can have your soil tested, right? Extension
yeah.
will do that for you?
Yeah, and that's actually a good thing. I saw that J.D. Gunnell, the horticulture ag agent here in Cache County, puts out a notice that gets published in the local newspaper and also online. And most of our hort agents around the state do that in their communities, and they tailor those things for local needs. But the one thing they always recommend is if you don't have a soil test, you really don't know how much nutrients to add in back to the system. And so by sending a sample to the soil testing lab at the university for a nominal fee, you can get an idea of what that is. Now, do you need to do that every year? No. Should you do it about every third to fifth year? Yes, because you are adding things to it. And what we really don't want to do is to build up some of those nutrient levels too high, because then what happens is that's just wasteful and you keep adding more. And, you know, the fertilizer companies like that because you buy more fertilizer. But in reality, it's not really necessary for the plants because they aren't going to take up more than what they actually need. So having too much in the soil isn't really a helpful thing. And then if you're adding manures and composts and some of those types of things to your gardens, that can supplement how much other fertilizers you might need to add, whether it be in an organic form or an inorganic form. Then, you know, that helps you also manage types of things. And so, you know, knowing what that soil is like is really, really helpful for you. And so just go get a soil test if you haven't had one in a few years. And I think it costs $15 or $20 to have that done. And the university's soil testing lab can give you a real good recommendation and kind of say, oh, yeah, for your garden, you know, this is what you're going to need for nitrogen, and this is what you're going to kind of need for phosphorus, and this is what you're going to need for potassium. And if you have some have had some issues with trace minerals, for an additional small fee, they'll actually test to see, well, do I need iron? Because people always think, well, I need to put iron on. Well, not necessarily. Do I need something else? And so they can help you do those kinds of things. And if you can't understand what that is, they do give you some explanation, but that's where the county extension office can help you. Again, they have individuals there that you can then go to and have them look at your soil test, and then they'll help you interpret those findings so that you're doing the right thing in your garden and not spending money someplace that you don't really need to. So soil temperature and soil testing is really pretty helpful. And it also gives you things like organic matter. Mm. It'll give you, you know, so you kind of know how, you know, rich your soil is and how it will hold water. And most of our soils are fairly low in organic matter. So I'm a regular believer in adding manures and things like that into my field. So I've got a couple people that I know that raise animals. And so I always go in the fall and get some manure from them and work that into the soil while I'm doing my final prep work in the after all the garden's done. And now that's been mellowed out all winter, and it's been, you know, breaking down slowly in under the snow and then during the winter conditions. And so my soil is so much better after doing that, you know. And I've been doing it for lots of years, so it's really nice to work. It doesn't get cloddy. It doesn't get, you know, hard and lumpy and all those things that people complain about. And you can imagine, you know, you build a new house and a lot of soil gets scraped around and moved. And so you may not have the best environment. And so by adding organic matter of some sort, that can really help.
Mm. Do you do composting?
I do. I've got a big compost heap, and now that's mellowed down, and so I'll go into that and do some turning and digging, and then I tend to use my compost slightly different than most people do. What I do is I throw it on the soil surface as the temperature starts to warm up and use it as a vapor barrier. Sometimes I use plastic mulches and things like that, but I find that if we just put grass clippings and other composted material around the base of plants, that helps to hold the water in much, much better, keeps the weeds down. So then I just have to eat produce rather than spend a lot of time working to eat produce.
Right.
and gardening isn't, you know, for the faint of heart, to be perfectly honest. You have to spend some time with it, but as my wife Dawn says, she goes, you don't spend much time out in the garden. I said, well, because I've got the system down pretty good, and so I can plant it, and then I can water it, and then I can eat it. And that's really the way I want to do it, because I got other things I want to do too.
Yeah, for sure. I want to follow up with that as well, including weeding. I'm sure you have a system to keep the weeds down, but let's take a break first.
Yeah.
We're talking with Dan Dross, gardening expert. He can answer your gardening questions, and love to get your question in to Dan. Here's a couple ways you can do that. upraccess@gmail.com is the email. Shoot a quick email with your question. upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Or you can call 435-797-8877, 435-797-8877. That's 435-797-8877. More following this break.
This is Science by the Slice. Large birds of South America, including brightly colored toucans, face serious survival challenges. deforestation from expanding agriculture and mining is shrinking habitats. Hunting and collisions with human-built structures also affect bird populations. USU ecologist Noel Beckman and her students are exploring whether interaction rewiring, that is, changes in interactions with new or different existing species, can counter negative effects from the loss of big birds. With their large beaks and bodies, big birds aid dispersal of the seeds from fruits they eat. Beckman says replacement species could mitigate, but not eliminate, the ecological effects of loss of big birds.
This segment of Science by the Slice is brought to you by the USU College of Arts and Sciences, offering degree programs in the sciences and mathematics. Details at artsci.usu.edu.
Thanks for listening to Access U Time. Tom Williams, and we're talking gardening on the program today. We have a gardening expert, UPR friend Dan Drost is in studio. Whether you've got a large backyard garden, maybe you'd participate in a community garden, maybe you just have a small box near your window, Dan can help. You get your questions to us right now. A couple of ways to do that. Email is upraccess@gmail.com. upraccess@gmail.com. That's upraccess@gmail.com. Or call us to 435-797-8877, 435-797-8877. Once again, that's 435-797-8877. So, Dan, I'm very interested, I think many of our listeners would be as well, in your system, so that we can be like you and you know, have our wives say, hey, you don't spend much time in that garden, but it's still producing nicely.
Yeah.
So I had a question about weeds. I imagine that's part of your system, so you don't have to spend all your day weeding.
Yeah, here's my system in weeding. Surprisingly, my wife, Dawn, really likes to weed.
Oh, that's your system?
That's my system.
Okay. All right.
And it's kind of ironic because, mm-hmm. you know, like anything, she says it's not something that she finds tedious. Provided she knows what plants to pull out, then mm-hmm. it's not a problem, you know. And so she's learned over years. And so we actually weed together, you know. And so I often will go out, we'll have supper. It's late in the day. The day's starting to cool off. And I'll just say, we got a little section to do. And over the course of, you know, 20 minutes or something like that, we just tackle a section in the garden. And we kind of do that. It's a little exercise. It's just a little stretching. It's a bending over. It helps with the digestion, I always say. So that is the roguing method. You go in and you're literally grabbing plants and you're pulling them out. When she was working, it was a stress reliever for her because whoever had annoyed her during the day, it was like, I'm just pulling these people up and tossing them away. Think of it as not a chore. Think of it as, you know, kind of a meditative type of thing. And so we tend to do it together. Take your hoe, take your scuffle hoe, just grab a plant and pull it up. If you do that regularly enough then and do it before the plant flowers, over time, your weed population in the soil tends to drop down. Mm-hmm. Now, the weed scientists at the university say, you know, the worst thing you can do is not to do anything about the weeds, because one plant will produce thousands and tens of thousands of seeds. And all you're doing is adding things in. Now, you would think, oh, those weeds will all germinate next year. No. Some of them stay dormant for many years, and some weeds for many centuries. You know, they found weeds that are very, very old and still will grow when put in the right conditions. So it's imperative that you go out and do it. So I do it by roguing, hand weeding, and using hose and that type of stuff. But I also use my compost. If your compost is clean, I generally try not to put weeds in my compost, particularly if they're got seeds associated with them. But if they're small plants, then they just go in the compost pile and they break down like anything else, and they feed back into the system. So I use compost. And then we talked about soil temperature. If I really want to kind of push things a little early, so with my earliest tomatoes, I always put I save my old plastic bags and I split those and I put them down on the soil and I cut a hole in them and plant my plants through them. Now you've got another type of weed barrier. It's a technique to use that can help you minimize what you have to do. And so through three different methods, you know, and time, the time component is now my garden has very few weeds, just simply because I've been very careful about not letting things reestablish themselves through seeding from the weeds that I don't like. And so that has really substantially reduced the amount of time that I have it. Now, a new gardener, somebody that's going to open up a bigger section in, let's say, their backyard, they're saying, well, I really, you know, prices of food are too high. I'm going to maybe produce a little bit more on my own. You know, you're going to have sections then that are new that have a lot of reserve seed in the soil already, and they get into the right position and then they'll germinate. And so you may have a little extra work there, but you can over time, you know, essentially solve that problem. Now, people that have raised bed gardens that they build and things like that, if you're buying well-composted materials, you're putting in, you know, manufactured medias that many of the places manufacture, so composting facility or something, you buy that from one of the local nurseries or garden centers or wherever you get this stuff. Those tend to be treated in such a way they heat the piles before they sell them so that it kills off most of the weed seeds. Not all of them, but most of them. And so those tend to be pretty weed-free environments. And so my sister-in-law has a big box in her backyard that she grows plants in, and she says there's no weeds in it, but her ground beds have lots of weeds in them because, you know, it's just the nature of those types of things. And so you just have to understand that different things happen. So grow plants in pots or grow things in raised beds, which make it easier on your back. You don't have to bend over so much. Or else find somebody or marry somebody who doesn't mind weeding, which is the approach that I took. Now, did I know this before I married her? No. Did I find that out? Yes. And it was it's a nice thing that she wants to contribute and help and do those, you know, kind of onerous tasks that we have.
Yeah. Well, and doing it together, that's nice as well.
Yeah, that's a nice thing to do, yeah.
So what about, I see a lot of these raised beds. Are there, of course, the advantages, fewer, maybe no weeds.
Yep.
You don't have to bend down as far. Are there disadvantages to raised bed?
Well, yes, there are. You have to remember that it's now above ground level. And so if it's a wooden box, a metal box, you know, that they're selling, if it's dark colored, temperature starts to build up in that root zone, and it builds up quite dramatically. And so you need to be conscious of the fact that the environment there may be detrimental to the growth of some plants. Now, our cool season vegetables, things like lettuce and radishes and those types of plants, when the temperature gets up above 75, they want to go to flower, okay? And the root zone temperature plays a role in that as well. And these boxes can get pretty warm. And so you have to kind of think about that and then plant accordingly. So you got to plant a little bit earlier. You maybe need to do something to try and shade it a little bit. It helps early in the season when it's cold. It's not a real good thing when it's hot. Also, those things are somewhat shallow. Some of them that you get are fairly shallow, like, you know, less than a foot deep. And therefore, the amount of water that's going to have to be added to that is substantial in order to keep those plants healthy, particularly if you're trying to grow a big, tall plant like a tomato in it. And then the other thing is that most of them are made with some type of what I call artificial media. So they might have a lot of peat in them. They might have some perlite and vermiculite, which are, you know, expanded rock-like materials, and they're designed to hold water, but they don't hold it that well. But the worst thing is they have very low nutrient levels. And so when you're actually watering, you also need to be feeding. And so I tell people, For those that want to do these things organically, it gets to be a bit of a challenge because you need to get enough nutrient to the plant because, as I said earlier, most of the breeders for these vegetables are breeding for productivity, and productivity is related to how much we eat. And if we look around at ourselves, you know, if I eat more, what happens to me? I get put on a little bit of extra weight, right? Well, in the plant world, it does exactly, if we have enough food there, it puts on the extra weight into the productive product, the fruits and the flower heads and the leaves that we're going to consume. But if I don't give them enough nutrient, then they're really stunted. They may take on off flavors. They might be a little bitter or pungent, or radishes that are a little bit sharp, you know, and you're just kind of going, what's going on? And it's all kind of related to water, nutrients, temperature, and raised beds and pots and all those other types of things that we grow in confined spaces have other challenges that you have to learn about. And so there, once again, the Extension website has interesting information about how to better manage those types of containers so that you're going to be more successful.
Hmm. I wonder about those who don't have any space at all. How small can you go? You see some people are growing herbs on just a kind of their windowsill, a little box,
right?
I guess that's doable. But can you do herbs? I've seen done.
Right.
What else can you do in a kind of a very small space?
Just about anything. Mm-hmm. Just remember once again that, you know, if you're going to try and grow corn, let's use that as a kind of out of the way example. If I'm going to try and grow sweet corn in a container, the bigger the container is, the better it will do. The more I water it and the more I feed it, the better it will do. But I usually have only one or two plants in that small container. And so from a effort perspective, I'm putting a lot of effort into a limited amount of productivity. So things like peppers do really well in containers. You know, so if you have a 2 gallon or 3 gallon pot, that will support, you know, one or two pepper plants. So you could have a cherry or a hot pepper and a sweet pepper in there. So you would have plenty of peppers then. I grow all of my basil in pots because basil is one of those plants that really likes warm soil conditions. And so it's, you know, all the neighbors come around my house to get basil, and I can't even tell when they're there because it just grows like a weed. And so I grow that type of stuff in it. Tomatoes will do well, but they need to be fed and watered appropriately. Early lettuce, early spinach, and those kinds of things. If you're into some of the fruits, strawberries do well. I built myself some strawberry towers, and essentially they're a larger pot with a smaller pot on top of it. And I just punched holes in the side of the pots to put extra plants in. So basically, I'm going to get a lot of strawberries out of a very confined area. And I just keep that on my patio where it's nice and warm. And it gets a lot of morning sun, but it doesn't get a lot of the heat from afternoon sun. So that means the fruit quality will be better. But I have to really start to watch the watering on that. And so they're starting to push. I need to start watering. I actually watered my strawberry towers this week simply because they were too dry. You know, we didn't get a lot of rain. We haven't had a lot of snow and the things that should help hydrate that environment. So, yeah, just about anything can grow in a pot, but it doesn't make sense to do everything in a pot. Mm-hmm. So I tell people, if you really want tomatoes, yeah, do them in a pot, but make sure that you're watering them frequently and you're feeding them regularly. You're kind of growing in an area where they don't get full sun all day long because the pot itself heats up too much, and that can be detrimental to how the plant grows in it.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another break. We're talking with Dan Drost, a vegetable specialist, gardening expert, and he's an emeritus professor of horticulture and extension vegetable specialist in the Department of Plants, Soils, and Climate at Utah State University. He does the Green Thumb for UPR as well. The March edition is up on our website, upr.org, and we'll have more following this break.
This is Steve Williams from Chicago, reminding you to please make a contribution to Utah Public Radio this spring pledge drive. This station depends on listeners like you banding together and supporting it. UPR will always have a special place in my heart, and I hope to see it continue to do great things for the community for years to come. And that depends on you making a donation at upr.org. Thank you.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, next time on Latino USA, a conversation with journalist and author Jelani Cobb about how this country's history of racism against the Black community helps us better understand immigration enforcement in the current moment. That's next time on Latino USA.
Tune in Tuesday morning at 11 here on UPR.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're getting some gardening advice on the program today. We're talking with gardening expert Dan Drost. He is Emeritus Professor of Horticulture and Extension Vegetable Specialist at Utah State University. Does the Green Thumb for us. You can find the latest edition of the Green Thumb on our website, upr.org. You can get a question to Dan by a couple of methods. Email is upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or call 435-797-8877, 435-797-8877. I wonder, Dan, is there an unusual plant that you like that maybe people don't usually plant in their garden?
Well, you know, I probably think not. I try to try everything, but I'm limited where I'm at. My garden, my house is relatively large, and my landscape is relatively small, and so I'm kind of restricted on what it is. Dawn said to me, "Why don't we extend the garden out a little farther and take out some more lawn?" And so I'm gonna do that this year, and that'll give me some opportunity to have some things. The bigger problem that most people have is most of them don't have enough land, okay? You think you have a lot of land around your house, but really when it gets to certain plants, you don't have much. If you're living in the older sections of many of the towns and cities of Utah, you tend to have a fairly big lot because that's the way they originally parceled things out. And people kind of had a cow or they had a horse and they had a big garden and all those types of things in it. And so you have those capabilities. But as soon as you start sticking trees in your landscape, it starts to interfere with what's going on in the garden. We need to have at least 8 hours of light to a bright light, not shaded light, to make a garden really productive. And most of us have, in older sections of town, have too much tree and not enough lighted areas, and so trying to locate where that's going to be. So my garden is on the west side of my house. We took out some trees because they were getting really old. And as a result of that, it opened up the light component much, much better. And so I get a lot of late afternoon and, you know, not really doesn't start getting fully sun till about, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then it stays pretty much sunned up till the sun goes down. So at this time of the year, that's problematic. There really is low light conditions. In the middle of the summer, it's almost too much. And then being on the west, it's always your hottest site, so I have to be cognizant of that. So I'm trying to always manipulate where I put plants relative to other plants so that it deals with the water issue that I have to have, because I try to use drip irrigation in mine. But I also use some of the taller plants to shade some of the shorter plants, and the shorter plants tend to be the cool season vegetables. And I really like to have lettuce and some of those salad-y type crops as long into the year as possible. Because Dawn always says, yeah, we buy nice, good quality lettuce at the grocery store, but it never tastes the same as when it comes out of your garden. Yeah. I don't know what it is about your home garden. Everything seems to taste better. Maybe it has something to do with because you've put in so much love and effort into it that you just believe it tastes better. But I think it actually does.
Yeah.
And so you got to be cognizant of those kinds of issues. And so a special plant in the garden, the one that I've been growing lately is Brussels sprouts. I love Brussels sprouts. Mm. And so I've got my Brussels sprouts transplants ready to get planted out. So late next week, they're going to go out in the garden. They're just about pushing the fourth leaf, true leaf on them. So they're just about the right size to go out there. They take the cold really quite well, but they don't mature until October. So it takes a long, long time for Brussels sprouts, you know. And so you got to really be committed to them. And not everybody's committed to stuff for that long. But we had a really fantastic crop last year. And this year I changed varieties. I got an older variety that was kind of variable. It had some real good sprouts on it, but it had some not so good sprouts on it. And by that, I mean some were real tight and hard like you would buy in the grocery store, but those are all from hybrids. And so I went and bought hybrid seed this year and had to raise my own plants in order to get them. And so I started those about 6 weeks ago. And, you know, they've been growing under my grow lights in a cool room that I have in the house. And I don't want them to grow too fast. I want them to be, you know, kind of hardened a little bit so that when they go out in the garden, when it's a little bit on the chilly side, yet they'll be well. And I grow broccoli. I've got kale. I've got a bunch of different types of lettuces. I've got some spinach. And then, of course, tomorrow I'm going to seed spinach and lettuce and kale and radishes and onion and those kinds of things so that I can have the crops that will go all the way till September, like onion, but I can have maybe some early radishes and that type of stuff for my salads. And my transplants then will also give me a slightly earlier. And with my hotbed, I've got even earlier. And so I should be really probably starting to pull stuff out of the garden around the last week of April is what I'm anticipating, which is about when people really start to think about planting stuff. And,
right.
And so one of the things I tried to do with the extension website is to make sure that when I was managing the garden component of it, we would get stuff there so that people could really start to think about how can I extend out that harvest window so that I can have fresh produce out of my garden earlier in the year and later in the year. And there's a lot of good information that's there. And it tells you when planting dates should be, when transplanting dates should be, when to start transplants. And so if you're going to start Brussels sprouts, the best thing to do is just go to your local nursery now, and they already have Brussels sprouts growing. And so if you want to plant Brussels sprouts, you know, growing your own plants now is kind of foolish. Just go buy some.
I just Googled it up. Of course, it's pretty easy. Extension.usu.edu.
Yeah, exactly.
And then
on the front page, there's usually a section that says garden. And you just click on that section, and then you start to, you know, get overwhelmed with how much information. Because if you're into the vegetable garden, you can find that stuff. If you're into your fruit trees, you know, have you pruned your trees? Have you done it correctly? Mm-hmm. It'll tell you how to do that. If you want to figure out how to manage your lawn, how to deal with weeds, how to grow shrubs, how to get flowers, all of that information is there available for the public, and it just takes a little bit of time, and it's been vetted. It's been reviewed by individuals. It's designed to give you the most accurate, applicable information. Now, I know some people in the Valley here that listen to podcasts on gardening, and they listen to people from North Carolina, from, Missouri, because maybe that's where they grew up. And, you know, you get the wrong information. It's the wrong information for our environment. It's not the wrong information. It's the wrong information for Utah, because they don't have conditions like we have. You know, they have X, Y, and Z, and we have A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. And so you need to use that Utah site, or if you live in Idaho, they have an equivalent type of thing, but our climates and that stuff aren't that different. If you're in eastern Nevada, use our site because it's applicable. But most states have these kinds of things, and Utah has just been blessed to have a lot of information on it for Utah conditions, and that's really helpful. And then if you're still slightly confused, don't forget yet, each county has an extension office, mm-hmm. and there is someone in that office that can, you know, kind of point you in the right direction or give you the kind of information that you need so that you're going to be a little bit more successful. Because if you're going to spend the time to buy plants, to get your soil tested, to ensure that you're watering properly, what you really want at the end of the year is a nice tomato. You want some good broccoli, you want some beans, you maybe want some corn, and you want it to be satisfying to you, and you don't want to say, oh, that was a bit of a failure. I've spent a lot of time to fail at something, and then that's disheartening and you don't do it. But if you have successes, when you have successes, you go, I can do this, and I know our citizens can do it because we've tried to provide them with the information that helps them do that.
Yeah. Earlier you said you want to talk about high tunnels in the hour.
Sure.
So what is a high tunnel?
Well, a high tunnel is just basically a passively heated greenhouse. So it doesn't have a heating source in it of anything other than the sunlight that comes through the plastic. And what the sunlight does is it warms the soil, and then the soil stores that heat and releases it slowly overnight so that it keeps the temperature up. And the plants being close to the soil, particularly at this time of the year, you know, can survive quite cold temperatures that the air may have because the soil itself is still warm. And so I'm trying to do that with my little hot cap structures or with my little row covers. You can do them very small type structures or you can do them quite big. And usually high tunnels are greenhouses you can walk in that don't have any natural heating source or venting source. So the two things you have to manage then are, you know, just managing temperature to a certain extent and then kind of understanding, oh, cool weather crops like about these types of temperatures, warm weather crops like these temperatures. And so what I'm trying to do is, you know, if I mix things in there, how do I manage the environment to accommodate both the cool weather crops and the warm weather crops, which have very different types of requirements? And that gets a little bit tricky. And so, if you need to know something about high tunnels, once again, the extension has a whole page of material on high tunnels, how to build one, all the way how to manage one, and what crops to grow in it. And you can literally grow anything in them. Mm-hmm. And so just think of it as a passive greenhouse that, you know, let the sun do its job. The sun is a pretty good heater.
Yeah, it really is, yeah. We just have a couple minutes left,
sure.
So let's just talk about the basics. Tomorrow, you're going to go in your garden and plant what?
Okay, tomorrow, earlier, and it was actually in February. It was a nice day in February. It was really pretty warm, so I went out and built my, you know, hothouse, so to speak. Little 14 inches on the sides with some cover on the top of it, and it just collects a solar collector for temperature. Last week I went in and I raked it out and I had dug it over last fall. So the soil was all ready. It was all fertilized and it's ready to go. And now tomorrow I'll go in with and plant rows of carrots. I'm going to plant two types of lettuce, kind of a semi-heading lettuce and a leaf lettuce. One of the varieties of the leaf lettuce type has some heat tolerance to it. So it's got varieties. It's a mix, so it's got some green leaf types and some speckled leaf types and some red leaf types in it. And they're heat tolerant because it can get kind of warm at times. I'll plant radishes. I'll plant kale. I'll plant some onion in there for green onions because I like green onions. And then I'll transplant some onion starts a little bit later in April. And so by having that stuff, you know, about a 3 foot or 4 foot long row. When the leaf lettuce starts to get ready, I just peel off the outer leaf and leave the main leaf growing. And that way I get a continuous supply of it. And so Dawn says, let's have a salad tonight. And I go collect some lettuce leaves and we're good to go. I'll plant broccoli and, my Brussels sprouts and that type of stuff, I'll transplant those the first week of April in the garden. And I might throw a floating row cover over them for a week or 10 days to get them established. And then they're on their own. And I've got my pepper seeds started in my because I got some special peppers that I like to grow that I can't find anywhere locally. And so I always buy some seed of that, and I got those started, and those transplants will be ready about the last week of April, and I'll put those out then with my tomatoes. And I just buy tomatoes locally. I don't raise my own tomato plants because the varieties that are here are quite adequate for me. I like a cherry type. I like some plum types, and I like some large fruited meaty types. And the variety is immaterial to me because they're all good. You know, they've selected good ones. And so I got that. My beans will get in. I usually don't grow peas simply because they're a lot of work, I find that, you know. So I don't want to do too much work. I got other things that I need to do. So yeah, that will happen. The rhubarb is starting to come up. So I've got my rhubarb starts. I don't grow any asparagus because I just don't have space for it. I don't grow sweet corn because I don't have space. I grow some squashes, but I always buy dwarfing type squashes. You can get those now because they're breeding them, though. So they're very compact plants for things like even some of the winter squashes now are coming on compact plants. So they don't have a big long vine and take up heaps of space in the garden, which I'm lacking space. So I got to think about those kinds of things. Mm. So yeah, I've got, you know, quite a diverse garden, and it feeds as well. And it feeds the neighborhood because I got a couple people in the neighborhood that don't have space to go. So I just say, well, you know, it's easy to grow. Mm-hmm. It's easy to give it away too.
Yeah, this gardeners make good neighbors.
They may, well. That's right, yeah. Excellent neighbors.
Yeah. Well, we reached the end of our hour. A lot of good information here. And if you need more, go to extension.usu.edu. A lot of great information there. We've been talking with gardening expert Dan Drost. He's Emeritus Professor of Horticulture and Extension Vegetable Specialist at Utah State University. Dan, thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Well, Tom, I love to come. So let's do it again maybe in the fall or something
okay.
like that.
Okay, sounds good. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.